Skull, everybody. This is Alexander Ludwig, and you are listening to The Wild Hunt.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, head on over to www.noship.net and check out our website. You can see all of the other television shows that we cover. And if you're so inclined, you can find out how to support us financially. But most importantly, leave a review for us on iTunes. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. And if you would like to be in contact with us, you can write emails in at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. We have a Facebook page as well as a Twitter page, which you can find access to on our website at noship.net. And also we can be reached through the TV Time app. So we are discussing today Vikings Season 5, Episode 5, The Prisoner. This was written by Michael Hirst and directed by Kieran Donnelly, which we've seen him direct at least two episodes per season since Season 1. For this recap, I broke it up by location. That seemed to be the easiest. And we are going to start with York because that's how this episode opens. It's sort of strange how this scene opens up because now we have the Saxons who are celebratory. And this is coming directly off the ominous line from last episode where we ended with, why are the rats above ground? So I wasn't expecting to see Saxons cheerfully, you know, parading the streets of York at this point, but that's what we started with. However, this hiatus from doom is made brief once the bells begin to toll and Haman once again lays his eyes upon the rats.
Yeah, it was weird. It kind of reminds me when like sometimes in television shows, you'll have the ending of an episode and then the beginning of the next episode is a reinterpretation of the ending to kind of get you back on the same page. It felt like that, which Hirst has never really done that before. That's not something that seems to be a tool in his chest, but it feels like he did that there because the first time that Haman looks at the rats, you're kind of like, he's not seeing this for the first time, is he? I mean, come on. We already had that establishing shot in the last episode. So I was expecting the explosion and I didn't get it, but I think it would have packed a little more punch, no pun intended, if something like that had happened. But
next we see what drove the rats above ground. The Norsemen work their way through the Roman aqueducts. Ivar and Fitzurk are both pleased with how Ivar's plan is developing. Now positioned below a drain gate, Ivar quietly gives signal for ladders to be positioned for their ascent into the battle. This apparently is supposed to be to their advantage, though the Saxons have the higher ground, and you would think the momentum for the Vikings to fill that space, it would be limited by a bottleneck effect.
Yeah, it's hard to tell unless you can see the whole layout of what's going on. On second viewing, I noticed that the battle scene becomes a little bit more plausible. I remember watching it the first time last night and going, wait a minute, why are these Saxons so surprised? It's like they're just watching the Vikings come out from underneath the sewer and then giving them space and letting them take out their weapons and then start fighting. It's like they should have fallen on them right away. But what I realized is that they only really do close-ups of where Ivar and Fitzurk are coming up, but they're actually coming up at multiple locations. So they have an element of surprise. Then on top of that, their archers are with them, whereas the Saxon archers are probably somewhere else because these are infantry troops or whatever the equivalent would be that came into the city. So they only have shields and axes and swords and whatnot. And then on top of that, they have somewhat of a space advantage because if they're coming up, first of all, these hallways are narrow. And then if they're coming up at multiple locations, they can kind of box them in.
Yeah. Yeah. But they still have to get up out.
They do. Yeah, they do. There should have been more casualties taken on the Viking side than there probably was in this fight because it's not that surprising. Once one of them comes up, it's like, all right, they should have started yelling and been like, they're coming up out of the ground.
You know? Yeah, it's not like the Vikings were equipped with stun guns and that was the first thing they fired at them as they peeked out from under the grate.
The Saxons were just acting like a bunch of stormtroopers, basically, you know, banging their heads on doorways and whatnot.
So now above ground, the Vikings begin their attack with Ivar semi-striding more confidently while throwing daggers, which is another minor nitpick. He's basically a slow-moving target. He should be easily taken out.
I didn't even think of that, and that's a good point. That's a really good point. Like, how hard would it be to throw something at this guy?
I mean, he's a vicious fighter on the ground, that's for damn sure. But, I mean, he's definitely got an Achilles heel. That's quite obvious.
He's just asking for a good clothesline.
Haman's now on horseback and he begins hacking with his sword while yelling about sending everyone to the higher power. And I thought this was interesting because he's yelling about higher power while he is literally the highest person physically placed above all those that are fighting. Aethelwulf battles hand-to-hand with verve and viciousness. Vitzerk and Aethelwulf go at it briefly, only to be distracted by other fighting men. A giant Viking with a sledgehammer fixates on Alfred. Now Ivar, he orders a volley of spears thrown into some of Haman's men. Haman purposely tramples a wounded shield maiden, and then the Vikings take out his horse with arrows. Haman is thrown violently to the ground. His breath and some blood burst from his mouth. Despite this, Haman launches to his feet and grabs a sword. He will not die lying down, not if he can help it.
And he's got that adrenaline flowing through him big time because he jumped up like with almost superhuman speed.
Yeah, it's like he landed on a freaking flat top.
He's like, ow, ow, it's hot, damn it. But he just gets up and he's just got that like, I don't even know how, it's almost like they sped the camera up. I know they didn't, or I think they didn't, but
I don't think they did. It feels like,
it looks like that. He's doing such a good job of this role.
He is killing it.
He is. And I mean, you know, they figured out that with the way his face is and his facial hair and then blood splatter on that, it's a good look. So yeah. They leave it on him for most of the episode.
Well, you know, it's amazing how like there's this great balance with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' portrayal of Haman here, because he is just delivering this amazing acting that's believable, but he's not taking over.
Yeah, that's a really good point. He's not trying to steal the show. He's staying in his lane and he's doing the best damn job he can do. And it's great. I had a little bit of misgivings that we talked about at the end of last season and at the beginning of this season about having somebody who has so much baggage attached to him as an actor, especially with other shows that have historical, you know, stuff to
that him.
That Michael Hirst wrote. So, you know, you're kind of like, okay, what's he going to bring as far as people's expectations of him? But my worries are put to rest. Now, I do have a little tiny nitpick with this scene. I wasn't so, it didn't bother me about them coming up out of the ground, like because of the reasons that I already explained. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the two fight scenes that they focused in on were a little bit unbelievable in their own ways. I think Aethelwulf would have killed Vitzerk, period. And I think this Viking with the huge hammer would have smashed Alfred into little teeny tiny bits. So yeah. I feel like both of those fights were fun for dramatic tension. They were fun to see these characters interact, especially Aethelwulf and Vitzerk, but kind of unrealistic in their own ways because they weren't evenly matched fights.
I can see what you're saying about Alfred and the Viking, but I don't feel like Aethelwulf and Vitzerk really took off. Like it never really got to the point where you can start measuring them up against each other as fighters.
Okay, that's probably fair, but I feel like Aethelwulf would take him out.
Probably, but it could also be your bias speaking too.
Well, I mean, you're ostensibly on the side of the Vikings, so you want to see them win. But it's kind of like, there's a good point, because we watched this last night, and your nephew, who's 12 years old, mm-hmm. was watching with us, and he said, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? And you remember what you said?
Remind me.
Yeah, just to paraphrase, you had said something to the effect of, well, you know, after watching this for so many years, you're kind of rooting for both sides at the same time, because you have people that have won over your sympathy on both sides of the divide, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't know that I don't hate Vitzerk. I don't really have it out for him or anything like that. I just feel like in a one-on-one with Aethelwulf, especially when he's in his own like berserker mode and smashing people's heads up against the wall and trying to protect his sons or keep them out of harm's way at the very least. I think that would be a one-sided fight. That's all.
I mean, yeah. I mean, with everything we've seen, it does seem like Aethelwulf has more under his belt. It would be more believable that he would win.
Yeah.
That he would make Vitzerk his bitch.
He would whip that ass.
We're back to where Haman has fallen off his horse and he has grabbed a sword and he's back up. Ivar commands for his own horse to be given to Haman. He is too great a warrior to fight on foot, is what Ivar says. And I thought this was an interesting statement from somebody who has no ability with his legs to say that. So it's almost like he's leapfrogging his inability to fight on foot by demoting it.
Interesting.
Or is he being sarcastic that this guy has to get on a horse to prove that he's a warrior?
I'm tussling with this one because one side of me wants to think that there's a certain amount of respect because they, you know, in the previous fight scenes in York, they kind of singled each other out and they fell short of actually being able to engage with each other. But because that would just be an awkward fight, because if one of them's on the ground and one of them's either standing or on a horse, it's not going to be a very fair fight, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, Ivar's really good on the ground game, so to speak. But then the other side of me said, well, maybe this is almost like a humiliation tactic. Mm-hmm. Like, because he knew that he would be outnumbered after that. So, because right after this, he gets the spears, the guys out with the spears, and has him kill everybody who was defending the bishop.
You know, and that's probably what it is, because that would make a lot of sense for somebody like Haman, who is so vain to where he thinks he's granting people the ability to reach eternal life and salvation, as he says to Ivar later in the end of this episode. Humiliation would be the antidote to Haman.
Yeah. So I guess you're right. I didn't really think of it like that. I just thought that was Ivar being Ivar, but it's good insight that he realizes this is what's going on, probably.
Huh. Interesting. So now Haman kisses his sword as a priest would kiss a stole. He stands before the Vikings and laughs in a scoffing manner. He turns and bows at Ivar disdainfully. Ivar responds with a theatrical bow, and anger ripples across Haman's face. Now, with Haman on horseback, fighting resumes after Ivar gives the signal. Now we're back to the hammer-wielding Viking, and he has not yet been vanquished. Cousin Manel has to convince Aethelwulf to leave the battle with Alfred. And this is for the sake of Alfred, because Aethelwulf is at first unconvinced. Soon after Aethelwulf's departure, Fitzurk witnesses Cousin Manel's brains take flight as the hammer Viking contributes one last blow.
Fitzurk thinks this is funny, too.
He does.
It's all a big joke to the Fizzgig. It's just a big joke.
Fitzurk is doomed to never win me over.
Well, you know, the jokes have all been made. He's the plus one. He's the middle brother. We talked about it at length last episode about how there just doesn't seem to be, I thought anyway, that there just doesn't seem to be much of a future for this guy. Because you know where Uba's going with his role, or you kind of get a feel for it. It could go in a lot of different directions. You definitely know where Ivar's going, and Bjorn went to go get his hummus. So it's like everybody has their place, but Fitzurk, he's just, you know, what's he going to do?
So now, back with Haman, he's once again pulled off his horse, off his high horse, by the Vikings. Ivar walks over to him to observe his prize. Haman yells with intense hatred, "Heathen." Ivar responds with a softly taunting but menacing, "Christian."
That was excellent.
It was.
I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, we were, like you mentioned, we were watching with my nephew, but my dad was also there. And my dad, who is familiar with Vikings, all three of us busted out laughing. And I think my nephew was confused.
He's like, what the hell is going on?
Why is this so funny? Ivar gestures for Haman to be taken away. We have a hashtag no ship. This is actually our only hashtag no ship for this episode. And we have Christian Callahan saying, "Dopest thing in Vikings since the first Blood Eagle and Lagatha castrating that guy was Ivar giving Bishop that hoe over there his horse to finish the battle. Real recognize real. Hashtag respect. Hashtag no ship.
Hashtag thank you for being the only one who did a hashtag no ship.
Yes, thank
you. For this
you.
Episode.
I think it's funny that you called him that hoe over there. I did have to look that up. I wasn't sure what THOT meant.
I had no idea myself either.
I agree that scene was dope, primarily because of Jonathan Rhys-Meyers acting and then Ivar calling him a Christian. Those were my favorite parts.
And it was played so well, because if he had yelled Christian to him, it would have been funny. It would have still had the same comedic effect. But the subtlety that's brought to it with his menacing little Christian and the smile is just, you know, puts the cherry on top for me.
Agreed. Back at the Saxon camp, Judith is among those tending to the wounded. Screams, blood, and rain fill up the scene. Aethelred sees his father and Alfred return. Judith asks after Manel and Haman. Aethelwulf responds that Manel died protecting their escape, but he has no words regarding Haman, because he probably thinks whatever Haman's going through is worse than death.
Yeah, yeah.
Aethelwulf is defeated spiritually as well.
The English are, I mean, they are just broken at mm-hmm. this point. They've lost York twice, essentially. And they're like spiritually and emotionally broken. Their leader has lost his faith in what's going on. He feels like God's not on his side. So nothing good is coming for them. These clouds of rain are not going to break with a big bright sun coming out anytime soon.
You know, Aethelwulf was a lot more guarded about how much investment he placed into God being on his side regarding this. Because some of the confrontations that took place between Haman didn't really reveal that for me personally. So I was a little bit surprised about his feeling bereft. Like he's.
Yeah. Well, I think he keeps his cards closer to the chest. Like he definitely actually. He actually possesses that humility about that.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to have when you feel like God is on your side as a Christian, to where it's kind of like this quiet dignity almost, and you've convinced yourself that this is happening, but it's not something that you have to be vain and glorious about and shout it out from the rooftops like our good bishop does.
Mm-hmm.
So they were good to play off of each other because they were two very different archetypes of how you handle being convinced that God's on your side.
So now we're back with Haman, and he lies chained to a hard floor with a pillar as his pillow.
Very uncomfortable.
Fitzurk sits calmly as he observes Haman, shaken the cold and the wet. Before Haman lies a large crucifix, relatively inverted to his own body position, and it has been decapitated. Ivar crawls around the pillar, emerging from Haman's blind spot. He must appear to be a demon.
That's exactly what I had in my notes, too. When he comes into the scene in the frame, he looks like the serpent. You know, and then when he talks, after they have their talk and he leaves, he leaves the same way, the serpent slithering away after he spews his bile in his ear. So I thought that was done very, very well, especially both parts of that scene, but especially I think the beginning when he comes right out from behind the other pillar.
So do you think there's anything beyond the significance of just despoiling a sacred relic? You know, in regards to beheading that Christian, I know there's a parallel because we're going to see beheadings later involving Bjorn. But do you think there's anything beyond that that's relevant for any sort of like Christian mythology?
No, not that I know of. Uh-huh. And I'm not the expert to ask. But just from my own opinion, I think that it's Ivar and mostly Ivar, but Ivar and the Vikings kind of like just throwing it in his face. This is what you were fighting for, and this is how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So there you go.
Yeah, I like that, actually. So later we have a scene where it's reported to Ivar that the Saxons have abandoned their camp. And so now Ivar sits with Fitzurk and he suggests pursuing and destroying the Saxons. Fitzurk thinks it would be better if they go back to Kattegat and secure their home base from Ube and Lagertha. Ivar agrees and thinks they should make an alliance with Harald. They will leave a big enough garrison behind to keep hold of York. Fitzurk wants to know what they should do with Haymond. Ivar would like to hear his suggestions, and Fitzurk thinks that they should offer him back to the Saxons for a ransom, but Ivar thinks it would be more fun to crucify him.
It seems to me that neither one of those things happened because both of them are bad ideas. If you crucify somebody like that, crucifying him is probably a better idea from the Vikings' point of view as far as psychological advantage than ransoming him back, because then you have a rallying point again. Because these guys, these Saxons, are just demoralized at this point. They've been beaten twice, just like I already described. They have so many wounded. Their king is in a funk. Their bishop is missing. Their warrior bishop. So to give him back, no matter what you got in return for that, it wouldn't be a fair trade. So Fitzurk with the bad idea. And, I don't know. What did you think of this scene, though?
Well, I thought the most important thing about this scene was showing how Fitzurk is rising in the esteem of Ivar, and Ivar's esteem, meaning that he actually likes how Fitzurk is thinking. And so that's why he says, well, what do you think about Haman? He decides to entertain, but then he doesn't like his idea. But
right, because it's not a great one.
Unless he's toying with him. So he does call him a good man after his suggestion to go to Kattegat. The first time I watched that scene, I thought maybe Fitzurk was testing Ivar to see if he was capable of killing Ube, and was disappointed in his answer. But then the second viewing and the third viewing, I don't think that's the case at all. I think Fitzurk means what he's saying, and he actually likes his newfound position within Ivar's esteem, and he was feeling it at that moment.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right about that. He does mean it. I feel like there's sincerity coming off Fitzurk when he says it, but this scene bothered me not because it was well executed or badly executed or a bad scene. It bothered me because of the character of the two people involved in it, because I said earlier that Fitzurk needs to either learn how to lead, follow, or get out of the way. Well, he's decided to follow, which is good because at least he's doing something. But it makes Ivar out to be a bad leader, and it makes Fitzurk out to be a bad follower. They're showing the worst qualities in both positions, because Ivar is getting his ego stroked And whether or not it's a good idea to go do what is being said, he's like, I like what you're thinking because you're praising me. You're giving me kudos and finally recognizing how great I am. And then, you know, Fitzurk is being bad because he's being the worst kind of leader or the worst kind of follower who is being slavish to their leader and is telling them what they want to hear. Even if they might believe it themselves, it's almost too much.
What was it he said that was slavish to you?
That he told him that he needs to be the king in Kattegat. You need to go back and kill our brother, kill Lagertha, because you need to be the king. Mm-hmm. You're that good. You know, it's not yesterday. It was barely enough that, you know, he was arguing with him about his plans. Now he's going, you need to be king by killing a bunch of people and doing this.
Yeah, I didn't read it as slavish. I mean, that's definitely a possibility. I just thought, you know, he was saying we need to maintain our home base because if Ube takes over, we're going to be cut off and then we're going to be really SOL here in York because we're not going to have our supply train coming, basically.
That's true. And I believe that to be the case, but he just kind of went a step further and then was like, and you need to be king in Kattegat. Like, why is that necessary? But there you go.
Yeah, it's interesting that Ivar thinks like making an alliance with Harald would allow him to keep Kattegat, but I don't know. I'm sure it would, actually.
It depends on how it was done. You know, if he could, because he would have to know that Harald is thinking, well, I'll let you maintain control of Kattegat for now if you take out Lagertha and Ube for me, who would be two thorns in his side otherwise going forward, but he would know that he's going to have eyes on it at some point.
I don't know if Ivar has any interest being king in Kattegat. I think he's just interested in being supplied. So if Harald were to take over Kattegat, as long as Harald supplies him while he's off doing his thing in England, he'll be happy.
So you think that maybe that's a good point. I didn't think of it that way. So that could be like a permanent alliance in Ivar's mind, like what he's trying to brew up. So he doesn't have designs on being king of Norway necessarily. He just wants to keep like spitting out his bile and rage and conquering new lands and being Ivar. So for that, he needs that rope of supply back to somewhere safe.
He wants to keep building the infamy of Ivar the Boneless.
He's putting his brand out there. He's just reemphasizing his brand. I could see that then. I could see him being okay with Harald being like, hey, listen, you give me what I want. I'm going to keep doing what I want. And I'm going to be Ivar, you be Harald, and we'll be good.
So now we have Ivar sitting with Heymund, wanting to understand why he is thought of as a heathen when he believes himself to be godly. Heymund offers to show him the way of God. He says, I could bring you to salvation and eternal life. Ivar responds with a, do you know who I am? And Heymund says, yes, you are the son of Ragnar and many fear you. Ivar tells Heymund that he is. So this scene ends up, and I've really truncated this scene quite a bit, but Ivar ends up telling Heymund here that he's going on a journey with them. And Heymund says, I'm already on a journey. And Ivar says, aren't we all?
So Bishop Heymund is getting Athelstan, whether he wants to or not. He's getting taken on the boat to a new land. And this is going to be a very different Athelstan.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot talked about how both Bjorn and Ube tend to come off like Ragnar in mannerism, where I think Ivar takes a page out of Ragnar's book based on the mythology of Ragnar, like the things he did that elevated him into fame.
That's a good point. Yeah, because he's doing it again. You know, he's taking somebody else.
So now on the boat to Kattegat, Heymund prays. Ivar asks him if this trip is an interruption of his journey or is it a part of it?
I like that little bit between them because I feel like there's going to be some heavy philosophical conversations between the two of them coming up. And I know it seems crazy at this time that it to me, it's just beyond the pale that you could ever take Ivar and make him a Christian. But Bishop Heymund, he's got enough pride and vanity in him that if he looks at the way the Nordic religion is structured, that some of that might appeal to him.
Now, I don't know. This is not Athelstan we're talking about, and this is not Ragnar we're talking about. I think what he's going to see when he's with Ivar is only going to reaffirm his beliefs about these heathens.
Yeah, you're probably right. When you put it that way, when you say that he's not Ragnar and he's not Athelstan, that kind of just puts the kibosh on that. Okay.
I mean, we've got a similar pathway in the fact that there's somebody's, it's not the, it looks similar, but it's not going to end the same. I mean, that would be silly for as story writing purposes. And
I'm not saying it's something that I would want to see. I'm just saying that, like, if you're bringing somebody over, you know what I mean? It seems to me like there's just certain elements of their culture that I think mm-hmm. that, you know, Haman is going to be enamored with.
All right, now we're moving to Kattegat. Floki arrives to Kattegat and Torvi observes his arrival and sets off to tell Lagertha. It's interesting to me how Torvi is always in the position to witness the arrival of someone. I wonder if this is because she is forever waiting for Bjorn's return, or is this also another tonal thing about Torvi that not only is she unrequited with that thing she needs with Bjorn coming, but also the fact she's going to be the first one to be able to know where the wind is blowing because she is always looking.
It could be, yeah. Because, I mean, she you're right. I mean, I don't know if she's purposely positioning herself close to where, because they didn't give you a shot of him coming in through the bay. He was just walking from somewhere. So I think he landed at his house first.
Yeah.
His old house, and then walked from there.
But
she was still there.
She always sees these things.
Yeah. And, you know, and no matter how bad Lagertha mistreats her, like she did pretty badly in last episode, I thought, mm-hmm. She still remains loyal and she still runs to tell her, to give her a heads up. And it's just like, I've said it before and I'll probably end up saying it again. Lagertha needs to realize that Torvi's worth her weight in gold, but, you know, just as an ally to have.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether or not she's going to listen to me is, you know, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, Lagertha would fare better if she treated her good people well, but hopefully Torvi recognizes that Lagertha is under a lot of stress and she has to know that this probably isn't normal behavior. Otherwise, she wouldn't be sticking around.
That's a good point. It's not like they had a scene here where Margaret is right next to her going, oh, no, don't tell Lagertha. Remember what she said to you a week ago. And she's like, yeah, that's right. Screw that bitch.
So now Lagertha greets Floki in the Great Hall. They speak companionably about memories. Ube enters and he and Floki embrace. Ube's questions prompts Floki to talk of where he has been. He describes it as on the edge of everything, yet at the very center of it all, which is a great line. When Floki says there were no humans but only gods, this is when he gets everyone's attention in the Great Hall. He then tells Lagertha that he wants to share it with true believers, those who are willing to live pure lives along with the gods, and he wants to take these people from Kattegat. Lagertha's ire is now up. She stands up, warns Floki from taking her best warriors away when she needs them the most, because she's got the threat of King Harald. So
what struck me most about this scene, I think her reaction to that was pretty predictable, because you don't want to deplete the ranks when you've got a potential, or not a potential, definite challenge coming your mm-hmm. way at some point. But what struck me more about this scene was the interaction where he says he doesn't know who he is. And she's like, of course you do. You're Floki, the boat builder. And he's like, but I'm more than that now. And then that she pulls back immediately and she sees where this is going. And, you know, she's just like, oh, okay, you're the pure one. You're the one who gets to communicate with the gods and understand their true meaning and intention. Unlike myself, unlike Ragnar, who was never quite as pure. And he doesn't deny that. He says, that's not for me to say.
But that was actually smart for her to lump her and Ragnar together. So in a way, she's kind of, because it's all transparent. Everybody's listening. You know, this conversation is not happening behind closed doors. So she's linking herself to Ragnar as far as like rule.
That's a good point. It is good. It's smart. It is really smart.
If that's what she meant to do. And the transparency is great for the people, but I wonder if her conversation wouldn't have happened differently, if maybe she would have pleaded with him, presented her case better to Floki, but instead she had to stand up and be commanding.
Yeah, she kind of skipped to, she missed a few gears in there.
Yeah.
You know, she went from first to like fifth.
Yeah.
It, you're absolutely right. It wasn't necessary. She didn't have to do that. Or maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong to say that it wasn't necessary, but rather a better tact could have been chosen.
What do you think the tact should have been?
The tactic, I guess, would have a better one would have been to say, kind of do the old arm around the shoulder and be like, listen, let me give you a few people, send a exploratory kind of thing with you, you know, to go check this out, to see if this is somewhere where we can grow crops, because you're a boat builder. You're not a fucking farmer.
Uh-huh.
So
let's, more on that later.
Let's have what the government calls a feasibility test and see if there's anything to this. That way it ties him up doing this. He can still bring some people over. He can still be happy that he's doing this. But see, that makes it sound like a very mundane type thing. And he feels like he's on a mission from the gods to populate this place with true believers.
Yeah. I've got more to say on that when we get to his last scenes here. So later, Floki meets secretly with those interested in Iceland. The trees are their only witness, and point out that Guthrum is one of these people. That's Torvi's son.
Mm.
He claims that there's arable land there. He says the perfect conditions for the growth of the crops and the growth of the spirit. We've already said that he was not a farmer. He's a boat builder. Does he even know what he's talking about? Does he know how to assess land? And if he does, despite the fact that he wasn't a farmer, is he lying?
Why would he be? Why would you think he would be lying, possibly?
To get people to come, to sweeten the deal. I mean, it's not like, I mean, would it even be immoral? I don't know. If this is like the ends justify the means in his mind,
okay,
would it be immoral to him?
Probably not, because their code of morality is a little bit different than we have it in the modern Western world, I would think.
I don't know about that, but if he really honestly believes that he's bringing these people to live in a pure fashion.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So if his intentions are pure to get true believers to go somewhere where the gods actually live, it doesn't matter
how he gets them there.
It doesn't matter how he gets them there, and it doesn't matter if he lied to them to mm-hmm. get them there and telling them that there's crops that they can grow when there's not. Mm-hmm. And they're all really just going to have to be fishermen.
So now we have Ube sitting with Floki on the docks of Kattegat. Ube tells Floki about the divide between himself and Ivar, and Floki's grateful that he's leaving so he doesn't have to choose between them. And he talks about the feelings of grief and joy and how they're actually the same. And I was like, really, please explain.
Yeah, I would have liked a little bit of extrapolation on that point. Yes. Because I kind of feel like they're the opposite. That's just my experience in life.
I think Ube's brow furrowed at that point too. Like, really?
This is probably why he calls him insane, you know.
Well, he wants to know from Floki if he really has found the land of the gods. And Floki asks, why would he lie? And that's when Ube says, because you're insane. And then he giggles in that signature Floki way. So we have another secret meeting where Floki's meeting with the chosen ones, as he calls them, and he anoints them with blood. And I'm not really exactly sure where this location is, but this reminds me of like an earlier set from season one, back when, Ragnar and company were conspiring against Earl Haraldsson.
Weren't they doing that at Floki's house though?
Yeah. And that's what it reminded me of. I don't know. It reminds me of it. I guess, you know, it's just similar construction and lighting because it's not like there was a lot on the market.
Yeah, really. There's not a whole lot of real estate there.
So he's telling them to get their families together secretly. He's going to go and prepare his boats. They will meet in 9 days' time. And, you know, speaking of, we've mentioned that Guthrum is involved, and I want to put out there, is this a sincere involvement, or is this at the request of Torvi because she wants to know what's going on?
So you think that Torvi could have put her son in there as a plant, so then he goes with Floki to see where this is all going and then reports back, kind of thing?
Maybe not as far as Iceland, but just to see what Floki's up to with people of Kattegat.
Okay. I could see that. Yeah, I could see that. But if their end result is the same, you're not going to let him take people, mm-hmm. do something about it now. Because the longer, the more rope you give him, the more people you're going to convince. And it's easy to kill one person, but it's very difficult to stop a movement, you know? And Floki has this regard. We didn't really talk about it, but when he came into Kattegat, people were treating him like a god. I mean, he just came from the land of gods, and now he's getting treated like one.
I'm taking back what I said at the end of last episode, because I had felt that he was actually the only humble religious person. I'm wrong. I'm so wrong about that.
I was in agreeance with that sentiment at the time.
Yeah.
And I think a parallel is being drawn between him and Bishop Haman.
I agree.
And what you have is humility in religion is a-okay, you know, as with Aethelwulf, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Hubris in religion equals a storm is coming, trouble's brewing, disaster on the horizon.
Right.
You know, category 5 coming your way to Kattegat right now.
Dust storm.
Yeah, dust storm. Whatever you want to call it. Bad fucking news. Mm-hmm. And so Floki didn't seem like he was perturbed by people treating him the way that they were treating him, as a living legend, as like a demigod. Like he got more of a response than Harbard, even though people didn't really know who Harbard was except for a select few. But they kind of knew he was a wanderer who was at least partly a god and stuff like that. But these people are just unabashedly like, Floki, you know, let me touch you.
Harbard had like a small set of groupies.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, unfortunately.
Helga, Siggy, and Auslaug. And then the groupies grew. But anyway, so anything more to say about that?
No, but, you know, I think when Lyrtha told him that she is going to forbid him to do this, I think it set a fire to his intention.
Yeah.
And this is going to be bad news probably for both of them, because nothing good is going to come of this. I think Floki and the seer should just go together.
Yeah, Floki doesn't even... I'd like to see him see the seer before they take off in 9 days. I want to see that encounter.
Yeah, that would have to be really well written, because I could see a lot of pitfalls in that if they didn't handle it right. It would seem just really weird.
I wonder if it would be contentious or affable.
Or they couldn't say anything at all. It would just be face acting and turning of the heads and and then some giggles and some and they're communicating telepathically. I don't know.
All right. So now we're moving on to North Africa. We got Bjorn, Halfdan, Sinrig traveling on camelback with Euphemius's company of men. Cassie is with them as well. This journey is long, as we see, because we'll have dusk followed by day as they make their way through the barren desert. They finally arrive to a tented village. Euphemius is greeted by one of the Emir's head, which the Emir is Ziadat Allah, who was mentioned last episode, and they are all invited into the tent. They have to give up their weapons before going in. Now in the tent, beverages are served. The Emir makes his entrance, to which Cassia immediately parts with her beverage and kneels with eyes cast downwards. Euphemius also kneels, but not as immediately, and the Northmen and Sinrig bow awkwardly in the background. The Emir welcomes Cassia, and she smiles warmly in return. So I think this is, it's weird because we had bowing also with Haymond and Ivar earlier.
Right.
Which there's a lot being told with these bows. You've got Haymond bowing disdainfully towards Ivar, and Ivar doing this theatrical bow like, carry on.
Lots of attitude between the two of them. Yeah.
And then now we have a lot of things being revealed here. We have Cassia showing that her deference, immediate deference, either that or her really excellent ability at playing the game and being on point at all times. And Euphemius failing to do so and revealing his lack of subservience to the Emir. And then you have the Northmen and Sinrig being foreigners bowing awkwardly in the background.
They're
showing their ineptitude in this culture.
Which they can't, you know, they're here to explore other cultures. Or, well, technically, they were probably here to raid until Sinrig, you know, convinced them to do otherwise. But they wouldn't have made it this far on boats. So I guess if you want to see what you want to see, you have to do what Sinrig says. So
next we have the Emir revealing his ability to speak the Norse language. Once he starts speaking this way, I love how Sinrig furrows his brow. The Emir and Bjorn talk about Odin and Allah, and the Emir says that their religion recognizes other prophets, and I felt like when he said that, it was his kind of like backhanded way of demoting the Norse pantheon to prophets. He mentions how he has heard of Bjorn, that his fame has reached all the way there. Bjorn now asks the Emir if he is the enemy of the emperor, and this line of questioning gives Euphemius away, and what I think is what happened, and I'm interested to see what was the main crime here. I think it's because Euphemius was a little bit too gossipy, maybe revealed too much about the Emir's true intention.
Right. My takeaway from it was it took me a while to digest this and kind of understand it, because there's a lot, this section of the episode, there's a lot of confusing shit that goes on that needs very subtle, very like one step ahead of you, the viewer, and you have to play catch up. And what I'm getting from it is that the Emir is the enemy of
The Emperor,
but he wants to keep up a good face. At this point, he's not recognized as an enemy of the Emperor by the Emperor. So, but Euphemius knows what's going on to a certain extent, but like you said, he's gossipy, can't keep his mouth shut, so he told the wrong people. That's why he got shot that look. Like,
right.
Dude, seriously?
There's too many people knowing now.
Yeah. Did you tell them? Really? Mm-hmm. And that he was dead at that point. So, you know, whatever pretext was used later on to kill, why he tried to run away or this or the, he knew what was coming. Once he got that look from Ziadat, he was just like, oh, shit.
So, and this is where the Emir I think, insults Bjorn because he tells him, you know what you need to do? Just take everything at face value. Basically, stay out of politics. Let's talk about trade. That's what you're good at.
Yeah.
That's what I want from you.
It is a slight. You know, it is a slight. Like, you're not, your big body holding your small pea-sized brain is not going to be able to understand these concepts. So just be a hulking guy and give me whale fur and falcons and, you know, all this other stuff that I can't get in this part of the world, dummy.
Later, Bjorn and Halfdan are smoking hookahs. Cynric escorts gifts from the Emir to both Bjorn and Halfdan. And both of these women were specifically selected for them because he says, this one's for you and this one's for you. So now we have a triptych sex scene. Bjorn and his woman, Cassia and the Emir, and Halfdan and Candy Darling.
Candy Darling.
The next morning, Halfdan asks Bjorn how was his evening, and Halfdan tells Bjorn that she was a he. Bjorn asks if that was a problem, and Halfdan doesn't answer with words. My interpretation is that it wasn't a problem for him.
My interpretation is along those lines as well. It wasn't a problem for him, but it surprised him that it wasn't a problem for him. And so the problem is that it wasn't a problem, and he's having a problem with not having a problem, if that makes sense.
Nobody can say that Halfdan is not living his life to the fullest.
Exactly. He's getting what he wanted. This is a granted wish syndrome right here. You know, you say you want to live life to the fullest, this is what happens.
And more coming in that vein for him.
Oh, yeah. He's going to keep living his life to the fullest until he doesn't have one.
So sometime after, Bjorn and Halfdan hear a commotion outside their tents. So now they're outside and there are men who are kneeling, and Cynric's explaining to Bjorn that Euphemius was placed under arrest last night and then somehow escaped. These men who are kneeling were the ones who failed to keep him secure, and so now they're kneeling in wait of their execution. They plead for their lives in vain. Cassia watches unmoved as their heads are lopped off. Halfdan sidles up to Bjorn and says, we haven't exactly been the best bodyguards, have we? Bjorn says, no, we haven't.
It's true, although if Euphemius doesn't tell them, hey, we need to get the fuck out of here, let's go, then they can't do anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Those women were given to them specifically. So Euphemius didn't run away.
Who knows what Cynric is failing to communicate, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. My take on this, though, is that Euphemius didn't run away. He was captured, taken under control, and these three men were killed as an example so that Bjorn and Halfdan could see this and whoever else.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a scene, there's no linkage scene there that shows you Euphemius running away or shows you him getting apprehended at a later time. There's nothing like that.
And so, there's no translation of what those three men are saying as they're pleading for their lives either.
Right. So given all of that, I feel like it was just all a sham. But if they're going to kill these three men and then end up wanting to kill the three stooges or the three musketeers, however you want to look at them, Cynric, Bjorn, and Halfdan later on at the end of the episode, why bother?
Because they know too much.
But I mean, why bother with the facade in the first place? Why bother killing these three guards?
I see.
You know, if you're just going to kill these three, I understand why they want to kill them, but why?
I see what you're saying. I don't know.
Yeah. So who knows? The jury's still out on that. Maybe, you know, when the DVD of this season comes out, there might be like a deleted scene that shows something more with Euphemius's character that provides that linkage that's missing at this point.
Or maybe we should just listen to the Emir and take it at face value and that Euphemius did try to escape. Because after he had those men's heads sliced off, you do hear the Emir saying, go find Euphemius.
Okay. All right. We could look at it that way, too. I just always feel weird when I always look for the man behind the curtain or the conspiracy when you have a situation that's in any way similar to that, that you don't see the person.
There are men often lurking behind curtains.
Yeah, it's true.
Later, there's a great feast and Euphemius is the main entree. He's tasty. The Emir tells Cassia that everything she wanted to happen has taken place and that they are now free from that monster. He then laughs as he says they have eaten his flesh. Cynric spits disgusted and translates for Halfdan and Bjorn, and Halfdan's reaction is my favorite.
What do you like about it so
much? He seems like at first like, huh? And then he's like, oh well.
Well, you know, I mean, this is the second time in a couple of days that he's had some meat in his mouth. So he's not really worried that, all right, haha. But I couldn't resist that one. You know, when the Emir says that now we are free from that monster, and he's talking about Euphemius? Or is he talking about the emperor?
That's the thing. I was wondering, because her reaction also seemed like, for a second, like she wasn't happy with what he said. Like, I feel like she's with the emperor.
Okay. It's plausible because I really don't know how or where the fuck she's coming from and what she's about, who she is, and what she can and can't do. None of that's been made clear to me. All I knew is that when we first see her, she appears to be a captive made into a slave who used to be a nun, who is ostensibly at least Euphrenius's lover. Then we find out later in that episode she holds some weight because she's able to kind of say, I will leave you if you don't take these guys to see Ziadat Allah. So he's like, all right, I'll buy breaks from you, you know, and we just go with that. And then here, we don't know, has she seen the emir before? Have they met before? If they haven't, I mean, she's just got it going on because all of a sudden he's doing what she wants him to do. And then you get to the point where Cynric, and I'm sure this is coming up in your recap, but Cynric is like, we don't have to worry about him. We have to worry about Cassia. Who is this woman?
It seems that there was recognition between the two of them when they were before each other for the first time in this episode. Mm-hmm. But it is possible that they haven't actually met in person. Maybe they've been communicating through messengers. Maybe that's who that guy was that, you know, they had observed when they were in Sicily. And so now they're finally meeting, but, you know, they're still keeping it secret that they've been communicating. I don't know. It seems to me that they've known each other some way, somehow, prior to this. I had also mentioned when we were talking about the episode last episode of our podcast that I had read that Michael II also was married to a nun. So I don't know if that's the same nun. They have different names in Wikipedia than her. Nobody's named Cassia in Wikipedia, okay?
But right. Which doesn't help matters when you're trying to figure all this out.
Yeah. But she seemed to bridle for a second. So that when he mentioned that monster, we are free from that monster. So I just for a second, I read her reaction as if she was not happy with that statement. And then when he says how we're eating the flesh of Euphemius or whatever, then she's happy, maybe relieved. I don't know. She's definitely laughing about it.
So the point of contention, though, was that Euphemius had been double-crossing, and he had been trying to reestablish good relations with the emperor. At least that's what we're supposed to think.
That's what he wants everybody in the room to hear.
Right.
Yes. So that's PR that's happening right there.
So now he's making it, whereas he was pissed off before that Bjorn and Halfdan and Cynric even were allowed to have an inkling that he could be, you know, against the emperor. Now he basically just fed this guy to everybody and said he was trying to get back on the emperor's good side by double crossing me, and that won't be tolerated, that he gets up and leaves the room.
Well, Cynric thinks it's Cassia that has a problem with him.
Okay. Yeah. Hopefully it will be made a little bit more clear in the next episode because it's not marks against, but I feel like there's pieces of information missing about the who's and whys and whats.
So like I said, Cynric thinks it's Cassia. He's the emir, as you mentioned, when he says about the double cross from Euphemius, and he says, now that was unacceptable, he actually turns and looks at Bjorn in a pointed fashion, like with emphasis. And that's when he and Cassia exit. So Cynric is worried and thinks they should exit to their boats. Now we're at the final scene. Bjorn is at the well getting some water. He's got a weapon there that we'll see that he'll use. So now everything involving Emir and Cassia comes to a head. Will Bjorn and Halfdan's heads roll?
And Cynric's.
I think Cynric's will.
You think so, huh?
Yeah. Find out next episode.
So the storm rolls in. Cynric says, hey, if we can basically just hold out, you guys can do some, you know, Viking magic, maybe, possibly. Save our lives, please. And so then that's when Cassia says in Arabic, according to the closed captioning, where she was talking in Greek back at the, you know,
in Sicily.
So, you know, whatever. But what I'm saying is she's got to be the one behind it all. Because, I mean, if she's speaking Greek there and then she's speaking Arabic, unless you're just everybody's bilingual, I don't know, or more.
The emir can speak multiple languages. So you're saying because she can speak multiple languages, that means that she's in power?
It means that she's not just, all right.
She's a nun who's probably got a lot of education under her belt.
I think it's significant that she's speaking Greek in Sicily and she's speaking Arabic here in Egypt, you know, or ostensibly this is supposed to be Egypt, right? Because they talked about Cairo something.
Yes.
So I think that's significant.
So. I'm not surprised by the fact that she can speak multiple languages. So I don't think the fact that she speaks multiple languages means that, oh yeah, she's in charge.
So it's everything else that makes you think that she's in charge.
Yes.
Okay.
The fact, I mean, Cassia definitely has sway. The thing is we're not actually privy to it. We just see what the after effects of whatever she's doing to people, because she has people secretly meeting with her. Actually, it was fairly open in Sicily, where, I mean, pretty much everybody around can see that guy, man in black, who stood out like a sore thumb against the bleached, you know, stone backdrop. But she has a network, and then she has people like the Emir saying, you know, everything that you wanted has happened. We don't know what her wants are because we haven't been told those. We've never heard those come out of her mouth. She's mostly silent unless she's singing. So I don't.
Or saying off with their heads, yes, in multiple languages.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully we learn more about Cassia. I'm wondering how much we're going to be shown about North Africa, because is it going to be treated like France was, where it's kind of like a moderate showing? Or are we going to get more of it like we did with England?
Like are you asking, are they going to come back?
Like, how much time are we going to spend? How much are we going to spend with these characters and get to know them and really start to care about them? You know, like we did with Aethelwulf and King Ecgbert. Are we going to develop any type of attachments? Are we going to really learn what's going on with the relations between all these people?
It would be nice to do that. It would be nice to spend a little bit of time doing that, because or at least they could use up, that sounds bad, but they could use some of the remaining time in season 5.1 to kind of explore that. Because I feel like if they just kill these guys, get out of this sticky situation, run back to the boats, and then hightail it back to wherever, and then get their fleet, and then go back and say, okay, here is the good places we saw to raid along the way, and we don't have to pretend like we're traitors anymore, then it's just kind of a little bit run of the mill. I would like to get deeper into that. Like, what is the actual relationship between the Emir and the Emperor? Cassia and the Emperor, Cassia and the Emir, and so on and so forth. It is kind of funny, though, that Halfdan said that she could just be a pain in the neck. And here he is with a sword at his neck at her behest. So
He's a soothsayer.
That does it for our coverage of that episode. So we're going right into feedback. And first up is PB&J. And he says, hey guys, in the spirit of the season, I would like to express my thanks and gratitude to the people of Vikings with the following gifts. To Bjorn, I give a clue to what the heck he's gotten himself into. Even Sinric doesn't know what's going on. Oopsie. To Floki, I give a flock. Every priest needs his flock, even if it includes the rated R superstar himself, Edge, which I guess is a professional wrestler, right? The Edge?
I think so. Metal Mike, that's what I seek you to inform me about wrestling. I know you like to talk about it.
Unless it's the Edge from U2, the guitarist, I don't think so. I wonder when Christian will show up to complete the tag team. Oh, I guess it has to be wrestling. I should just read it before. I kind of hope Ubi goes with him and farms the land. Too bad his destiny isn't behind a plow. To Lagertha, I give understanding, since she seems to be completely lacking of that quality. She may be queen of Kattegat, but Floki answers to a higher power. To Ivar and Heyman, I give an autographed copy of The Bromance of Ragnar and Athelstan, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Clearly, they are brothers from different mothers and need to be best friends. Can't you just see the anti-Ragnar and anti-Athelstan conquering the world together?
Oh, I can. Don't know.
They could get their own spinoff show.
Yeah.
The Odd Couple, you know, but like back then.
Is Heyman even going to make it back to England after all is said and done? He has to, unless they're going to go against history. I mean, they're already going against history just bringing him to Scandinavia at this point. It's kind of exciting because I don't even know what to expect. It's definitely not going to be what took place between Ragnar and Athelstan.
No, but you know, it always begs the question when you see something like this going on, how close are they going to hew to the actual history of stuff? How close do they have to make it plausible? Or, you know, because these written histories are really probably just only versions of what happened anyway. So it's kind of good that license can be taken with them and saying, this is probably almost as likely, you know, than what we know, because how reliable are those sources? I mean, what if the world blows up tomorrow and the only history book left is written by Trump?
Oh, stop.
You know what I'm saying? And then everybody in the future is like, no, 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 no. That's what happened. you know, and then podcasters in the future are going, well, wait a minute. What if this guy wasn't completely right? So I'm not trying to cast aspersions on historians to that degree. I'm just saying that there's a little bit of leeway, so have fun with it. And finally, to Steve, Em, and Paul, I extend the warmest of season's greetings, the merriest of Christmases, and the happiest of New Year's. Sincerely, PB&J.
Merry Christmas to you as well, PB&J.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much, and happy holidays to everyone. Happy New Year's.
Everybody.
Eat lots of great food. Get fat.
Get fat. Stay safe. Drink eggnog with whiskey in it, and don't drive.
Yes.
And have a good time.
Spend time with friends and family, and be merry. All right, up next, we have Donuts, and she says, Hola, no shippers. Another great episode, although I am starting to fear we may not get much meat on the Ifriqiya story in favor of the Bjørn-Dan bromance roadshow, so that was a lower point as much as I enjoyed it.
There's definitely a lot of meat going on. This is definitely, anyway.
Donuts goes on to say, Euphemius, when the Emir said he was not against the Emperor, the living version of Chrissy Teigen's uncomfortable grin gif. Hilarious. Yes, and I know that gif.
I don't think I've seen that one, but
I will show it to you.
Okay.
Donut says, the juxtaposition of the horrific post-battle triage and amputations in the storm and Mud versus the chefs comically hacking up plot device or Euphemius in the desert. Unexpected and fun. So many questions. How did Cassian know the Emir to inspire this coup? Could he be the reason she was sent to their nunnery in the first place?
Ooh.
Was she a plant? Did she serve the Holy Roman Emperor first? So many questions.
Exactly. That's what we were saying earlier. There's missing information here. We can't be the detectives that we want to be without some more clues.
Bjørn asking Halfdan if it was a problem for you. An example of Ragnar mugging done right. So was that an accident or did someone figure out Halfdan prefers men?
I think it was a lucky guess.
I mean, they were selected for them.
Yeah,
this one's for you. This one's for you.
How would you figure that out, though, just from... Because that was like their first couple of hours that they were there. Their first night, you know?
Donut says, the sound work with bells ringing above ground and in the sewers of York. Loved it. Hammer Guy, another Thor reference for this season. Savage as fuck. Ivar having Haman kneel in the bloody street where they were dumb enough to lead their people, literally stuck in the road of the journey he professes to be on. Identity crisis. Ivar is so concerned that everyone know who he is, speaking to his insecurity and identity, while Floki has completely let his identity go, claiming he doesn't know who he is. Both are dangerous because of this. Ivar driven to prove himself at all costs, and Floki having no loyalties left to honor.
That's an interesting take on it, because instead of matching up Floki with Haman like we were doing, you're matching him up with Ivar, Viking to Viking, and it's good observation.
Yeah, I mean, Floki's loyalties were always few to begin with, but now he has none, so...
And it's probably really liberating to him.
Donut says, this episode had the same director as all his angels when Floki murdered Athelstan, and it really shows. Same street walk, same hair-raising atmosphere, religious symbolism everywhere. From the anti-biblical upper room with his disciples to the wait for me in X days like Jesus, except instead of the trinity of days, 9 days for Norse religion. Fantastic. So if Floki is now the church after his Jesus, Ragnar died, does that make Lagertha and Kattegat the Roman Empire? A dangerous symbolic position to be in, indeed.
Or so Floki is the church after Jesus.
After his Jesus.
Who is Ragnar, died.
Uh-huh.
So now Floki represents the church after Jesus is dead, and Lagertha is, and Kattegat,
the
Roman Empire, trying to persecute him and saying, don't try to take people over to your side because we don't need the depletion. Nice one. And it is a dangerous symbolic position to be in indeed.
Donut says, Merry Christmas, blessed Yule, and happy holidays to all. The No Ship crew is the absolute best, and your discussions and community have made me a better watcher and a better writer. Oh, that's high praise coming from you, Donuts. Thank you for saying that.
That's kind of ironic that you would say that, because your letters have actually forced us to be better podcasters.
Yeah.
So we can be ready to answer stuff and act, or at least comment on things. So it's a... You know, time is a flat circle and one thing influences the other. And yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Sometimes like I read what you write and then my brain just flatlines like, I'm just going to turn off.
Like,
I can't perform.
Bjorn asking Halfdan if it was a problem for you, an example of Ragnar mugging done right. I completely agreed with that. And
you said it out loud when we were watching it.
Yeah. I was like, that was the best channeling of Travis Fimmel that has been done this season. Bar none.
So, I mean, she's talking about how, like, the Saxons were dumb enough to lead their people into the street. Does that coincide with what you were thinking was happening with the Viking strategy?
As in the sense of It was stupid. Like they get in there, they think that everybody's gone. Their guard is down, even though they still have their weapons, and they're not expecting what's going to happen. They're not expecting to get boxed in. They're not expecting to have archers appear from underground and then to just lose when you are on the, you know, to have victory snatched right away from you like that. It demoralizes you. It surprises you. You're at a disadvantage, even if you technically have the higher ground. And so it's no surprise that they lost so badly.
All right. Thanks, Donuts. Up next, we have the undefeated Sam.
Are you ready, York? When you enter a city occupied by your enemy and instead find rats in an odd place, it's, points to Admiral Akbar,
a trap.
Not time for a celebration. I never would have guessed Ivar's plan was to pop up in the middle of the Saxon army. That's some scary shit, waking up to that crazy looking sumbitch crawling towards you. Not liking how Lagertha is being portrayed this season. It's also like the show isn't certain what to do with her. Her sudden turn on Floki seemed unnecessary and even overly sensitive when she accused him of referring to her and Ragnar. Yeah, I think he's talking about the point where she seems like she maybe got a little bit butthurt about, oh yeah, we're not one of the faithful,
yeah,
and things like that. But you know, I stick by the point that you had brought up. She was clinging to Ragnar for that name recognition because everybody was listening.
You know, I did read it like how Sam's describing it the first time. Like maybe she was just like, oh yeah, because you know, like I'm not pure and Ragnar's not pure. I read it differently later.
Nobody's good as Floki. Look at me, Floki. She starts doing a church lady dance. You know, could it be Floki? So, what's with the random Halfdan scene? Is it just for a gag? Oh, I don't know if he gagged or went past the gag reflex here. It could. I don't know how they're trying to play this one. It's good entertainment.
He's getting life experiences. That's what's going on.
Yeah. Roasted dude. Pass the fava beans and hot sauce. All they needed was a good Chianti. Not as smooth as other episodes, and the Lagertha and Floki scene didn't sit well with me. I am interested in what happens with Super Priest and Ivar.
Super Priest.
Super Priest. Super Priest. He's a very super priest. The kind you don't take back to Norway. All right, this is stupid. Super Priest and Ivar, that sounds like a good comic book. I'm done, but remember to eat some veggies with your roasted man flesh. Although Halfdan also likes it raw now. All right, that's my last one for the night. Sorry. Thank you, Sam.
Yes, thanks, Sam. And everybody if you're celebrating the holidays, have a great time. Be safe, as Steve said. No drama. Just go along with the flow. Don't start any fights with family members.
If it's not worth it. Yeah, if you can. Sometimes it's not possible not to. We understand that. But try your hardest. Yeah, because we won't be... it's good that we wish everybody a happy holiday, because the next time you hear our voices... If you're listening to this very soon after it's put out, we'll be close to the new year.
Yep. And we recorded this a day early. We announced in the last two podcasts. So we apologize if anybody didn't get that notice and are sending your email in late, and we will read it next time.
Yeah, you will
get the case.
You will get read. And so don't worry about it. This concludes our coverage of Season 5, Episode 5, The Prisoner. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Em.
Heathen.
Christian.
Good night.
Good night.